Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org and our first program for 2014, excuse me. So happy new year to all of you. I'm Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us, especially considering the weather out there on the East Coast. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us, and we do want you to take part in this discussion. If you need assistance, please select Help Desk from the drop-down options in either the Q&A panel or the chat panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you. Now, for our last few programs, we have been learning about different organizations that share aspects of the emergency management mission. Today, we will hear from the Infrastructure Security Partnership, whose focus is on resilience for all hazards and not just terrorism. First, for the benefit of any first-timers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed with your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you just to hold off with your questions until that part of the program. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my great pleasure to introduce the Director and Chief Operating Officer for the partnership, William B. Anderson. Under his leadership, they have developed a number of resources you may find helpful, so please note the links on our background page to a few of those. Welcome, Bill, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. And I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bill Anderson. I am the director of the Infrastructure Security Partnership. I want to say thank you to the Emergency Information Infrastructure Project for inviting me to introduce all of you to the Infrastructure Security Partnership, otherwise known as TISP or TISP, and able to provide this brief on our efforts to improve the resilience of the nation's built environment. On a volunteer basis, we've been working on resilience as a concept and strategy for communities to work together to withstand the impacts of all types of hazards or when they have been disrupted, to band together and recover, otherwise known as bounce back, as quickly as possible. We've been doing this for over a decade now. Many of you may be familiar with FEMA's whole community and national preparedness systems. These are examples of the federal strategic policies and programs for the national resilience effort. Today, we've been seeing agencies spend more towards these resilience programs in their specific sectors, such as the EPA has a community water resilience program. The Office of Health Affairs in the Department of Homeland Security has its Community Health Resilience Initiative. And most recently, you may have seen the announcement out in the Federal Register for the Federal Transit Administration looking to spend $3.7 billion on making public transportation systems more resilient. Those are just a few of the examples where the federal agencies have begun spending a little bit more money on these particular areas. And today what we're going to be going through is how we are working with many of those agencies, but also what you can do to work with us on this topic of resilience. TISP is a national public-private partnership with a mission to lead collaboration that is advancing the practice and policy of regional infrastructure security and resilience. Our partners and members are governmental agencies at all levels, so that means state, local, and federal. It's professional societies and other non-for-profits. It's also large and small companies. We got our start with the engineering construction professions around the subject of building stronger infrastructure through the critical infrastructure protection programs. We have since grown our membership to include emergency managers and operators, first responders, attorneys, transportation and public works managers and operators, community and county planners and commissioners, risk and resilience assessors and managers, regional public-private partnerships, the academic and research communities, national defense, and international communities. So we've expanded quite immensely over the 14 years that we've been around. CISP is governed by 21 officials on a board of directors, which is currently chaired by Ernie Egger of Atkins. CISP is more like a coalition. So when we say a public-private partnership, we're not an established 501c3 as an independent entity. We rely on a benefactor organization for the purpose of staffing and financial support. Currently, CISP is a division of the Society of American Military Engineers. The values of this relationship is that we have access to SAME's 105 state and local committees for emergency preparedness and infrastructure resilience. This is a true grassroots machine. And if you're not familiar with the SAME posts in all 105 locations, you can always reach out to us and we can get you connected to the folks within your particular region. Before SAME, the American Society of Civil Engineers was our benefactor. The reason why that the Society of American Military Engineers is our benefactor, our missions are closely aligned with an interest in national defense, emergency preparedness, mission assurance, and regional resilience. So there is a synergy between our two organizations. The primary functions that we provide to our partners and members are we provide a national leadership for cutting-edge subjects around resilience. We also build and strengthen partnerships and networks where they already exist, and sometimes where they don't exist, we help establish them. We also serve as an educator and help share information among our members regarding specifically these areas of resilience and what our partners have been working on. If you're interested in learning more about our activities, TISP publishes an annual report, which SAME produces in its magazine, The Military Engineer. The report can be downloaded from SAME's homepage at www.same.org or on our homepage at www.tisp.org. The report includes details on some of the events and initiatives which nearly 450 individuals are actively working via our board of directors and committees. If you're interested in learning more about our activities, we recommend you sign up to receive the Resilience Today, which is our newsletter that goes out to over 8,200 people. Or we recommend that you sign up for our LinkedIn group, which currently has a little over 950 people on it. So much that is happening around this topic of resilience, so we rely on our partners to share information with one another, as I stated earlier. And to do that, what we typically do is develop strategic partnerships to help ensure that resilience is developed in a competitive yet a compatible system. So what we do is we develop these relationships so that when we get around a table and we talk about these particular items, we do so with the purpose of coordinating and collaborating for the potential business and partnership opportunities. Some examples of the partnerships include the Applied Physics Laboratories, which has been developing a resilience implementation process. The National Association of Counties, which is developing a presidential program around the topic of resilience, and the National Academies, which is getting ready to release its demonstration program that they're calling Resilient America. So there's some good information going to be coming out very shortly from them. We also had established other relationships with organizations like the Homeland Security Policy Institute, the Office of Infrastructure Protection, and the American Bar Association. And we'll go in a little bit more detail around each of these three relationships further in. These partnerships never stop. We continue to grow them on a regular basis, so we're always interested in learning more about these other organizations that have a common interest or a common mission. So if one of your organizations is currently working in this particular area and you'd like to develop a strategic partnership with us, reach out to us. We'd like to learn more. So that's a bit about our organization. But by now, each of you have used this term resilience already in your daily tasks or have heard somebody else use it. But we have yet to see a true demonstration of a resilience program that is done on a regional scale. You could talk about port security, for example. That is a good example where you have multi-stakeholders working together on making decisions and addressing the interdependencies, reducing the risks through mitigation strategies, a whole host of activities in that. But that's only with one specific jurisdiction. Very few of those port security programs actually extend outside of the ports. Some of them do, and those are some wonderful examples. But a true, mature resilience program has yet to be demonstrated nonetheless. So why do we care about this? Why is TIS spending all of this time talking about resilience? There are a lot of answers that almost any of our partners can give to this particular question. But from our perspective, we care, as we stated earlier, because we focus on the built environment. And at this time, or over time, and through many different disasters, we have seen repeatedly that we haven't learned from our lessons. We haven't built the infrastructure which can actually withstand hurricanes or all tornadoes or earthquakes. We've been doing a lot to improve those things, but we haven't built the infrastructure that has been able to withstand all hazards. And from that aging perspective and from all natural and man-made disasters. So that's one of the reasons why we care about this particular issue. But the real reason why is a cost scenario. ASCE's report card says we're doing poorly with our infrastructure, maintenance, and operations. Their message is not getting through to decision makers for them to take action and make improvements. Since they can get into the decision makers basically can get into their car, they can run their errands, they can go to work, they can take their kids to school, they can watch TV at home with the power that's provided to their homes, they can take showers without risks of the water shutting off on them usually, and all of this is done without frequent interruptions, which impact their daily lives too greatly. So in other words, they don't really see the impact of having a D-plus grade affecting them on a daily basis. But when a disaster strikes, they see it then. Over the last 4 years, we spent an average of $80 billion of our federal tax dollars on rehabilitating our infrastructure. That is rebuilding our infrastructure to the same state, the same minimal construction standards that the building contained before the disaster. In other words, we're just rebuilding it so that it could be knocked down by the same type of disaster that hit it in the first place. And keep in mind, this is not particularly an issue that only the United States is facing. The UN quotes that between 2000 and 2010, our developed and developing countries spent over $1.4 trillion on response and recovery, and we lost more than 1.1 million people in that time period to disasters. One point that we need to make here is that when we're talking about the federal dollars spent on this, we're not actually looking at the money that was actually spent by the development authorities. We were not talking about the money that had been spent by the insurance companies, and we're not talking about the money that was spent by state governments. So we do spend more than $80 billion on average to recover. So these are particular concerns, and we know we can actually do better. But we just can't throw money at it. We know that. Infrastructure project procurement and appropriation is part of the problem as well. Think about it. Can the federal government afford a major construction project such as the New Jersey Turnpike today or the Hoover Dam today or a transcontinental tunnel today using the traditional funding streams that had been put in place years ago to build many of those things? We really can't. Our infrastructure funding has changed. We rely on corporate investors. We rely on cost sharing and fee-for-use and revenue sharing. These types of public-private partnerships and contracts have unintended impacts and newer risks that we weren't really noticing before. First of all, since our national funding streams are failing, the taxpayer has less of a say in the public safety and security. The project proposal phases typically require the developer or designer to get approvals from all the stakeholders, basically make everybody happy. So that has an impact on the amount of time that is actually spent during the project proposal phase. You also have the environmental impact assessment through NEPA, which has a lengthy process to that, and no time limits basically for making decisions on the proposal period. So that adds to the time and cost of projects. And laws, regulations, they don't keep up with public-private partnership models. So most of the things are actually addressed through concessions within the contracts. And as you know, all contracts are debatable. So there's a particular risk there. Liabilities for risks and failures have been transferred basically from the public sector to the private sector. So there's more responsibility on the companies and what they are confronting today. You have contracts based on fees for revenue, typically disincentivizes developers to utilizing resources that optimize the asset use and design to meet the minimal standards, industry standards. These same agreements also disincentivizes the developers from using newer engineering innovations or technologies or construction materials that could extend the life of a system. These are all particular concerns. So what is resilience? We already asked that question a little bit earlier, but there are a lot of definitions that you can look at out there today. You can find a federal definition in Presidential Policy Directive 21 for critical infrastructure security and resilience. The two best definitions that we see out there today really are the National Academies in their August 2012 report entitled Disaster Resilience and National Imperative, and also the Infrastructure Security Partnerships definition as we have on this particular slide. Both the National Academies and TISP offer up a definition which gives the owner and operator the opportunity to make a decision. Absorbed the impact or mitigate against it. There are other options than just mitigating risks and consequences. You can't actually absorb them if it's not actually going to shut you down, or if you're able to bounce back quickly from that disruption, then that might be a better option than spending the money on that particular mitigation item. It is important to remember when working on your own resilience programs, it is important for all of the stakeholders to have a common understanding of the term used. Since there are so many definitions for resilience out there today, it may be helpful to use the Webster Dictionary, which is basically the basis for all resilience definitions. An understanding that resilience means the ability to either withstand and or bounce back from any disruption or disaster. If you'd like a little bit more information on resilience and what it's all about, we do offer up the Understanding Resilience booklet. It's a compendium to the 2011 edition of the TISP Regional Disaster Resilience Guide. The booklet educates the reader as to the importance of targeting resilience initiatives at the regional and infrastructure levels. The booklet has been referenced in recent national dialogues questioning whether resilience is a public good as well. And at the end of the booklet, you'll find a list of reading material that you can use for understanding more about the initiatives around the country today. As stated earlier, TISP has focused on resilience in 2003. In 2006, we published the Regional Disaster Resilience Guide. It is a how-to guide for multi-jurisdictional partners to develop an action plan for improving the resilience of their self-defined region. The 2006 RDR guide was used by a few states, such as Maryland. It was used by the Water Works Association in framing their Water Wastewater Agency Response Network Program, otherwise known as WARN. It was used by the Corps of Engineers in developing their dam sector exercise program. And it was used by the Community and Regional Resilience Initiative to develop their Resilience Systems Toolkit. In 2011, we published an updated edition of the Regional Disaster Resilience Guide. The updates to the guide were made from the recommendations by the initial users of the 2006 edition and also through the lessons that had been shared from more recent disasters around that time frame. It's important to note here that sharing your lessons learned is very important. Organizations such as ourselves and many of our other partners actually learn from that and use that information. And you can see the changes between the 2006 edition to this 2011 edition as evidence of that. In 2010, the TISP Board of Directors established the Regional Infrastructure Disaster Resilience Task Force. I called it the RIDER Task Force. This opened a cooperative task force, which was chaired by Dr. Paula Scalingi of the Bay Area Center for Regional Disaster Resilience, made up of 115 stakeholders, were tasked to revise the RDR guide to be relevant for the next 5 years, and they were also tasked to develop an educational tool for understanding infrastructure resilience, thus the Understanding Resilience booklet. The task force worked well together, and the product was then reproduced with our permission as a chapter in McGraw-Hill's textbook entitled Homeland Security Handbook, which was edited by David Kamen and is currently available on Amazon.com. Now, the task force was tasked by the Board of Directors with two basic objectives. One, keep the guide brief. We all see what happens when the documents are too long. They get ignored. They collect dust on a shelf. They're used as doorstops. We didn't want any of that. We wanted to make sure that the service we provided to you was going to be a value to you. So we made it our effort to keep it as brief as possible. Two, they were also tasked with the objective to make the guide as user-friendly as possible. As you can see with this particular slide, we attempted to make that how-to process as simple as playing chutes and ladders, is what I like to say. As you maneuver your way through the game board, basically, you are provided with a list of 14 focus areas that are priorities for most regions. Not all will apply to each region. It's up to you to make the decisions on and your stakeholders to come up to an agreement what your priorities are. These are starting points which include your needs for addressing all hazards. Each focus area also includes a set of recommended short-term, mid-range, and long-term activities, so it gives you something to work together on. And the guide is intended to strengthen and enhance your resilience without causing confusion. We use plain English. We try to use very few acronyms. You will see a few acronyms out there, such as the RDR guide and TISP. And the guide also includes a set of key definitions and fundamental principles so that it can help focus all the stakeholders around one basic concept, and you know you're all working in towards one particular direction with a set of principles behind you. The scope of the Resilience Action Plan, it covers the typical life cycle for disaster management, which means most of you on this webinar would be familiar with the process. It covers the development of situational awareness, and it also highlights dependencies and interdependencies between the sectors. The guide is not designed solely to address terrorism. It covers natural and man-made hazards. It also includes recommended incentives for cross-sector, multi-jurisdictional collaboration, which would be the foundation for a lasting stakeholder partnership for the implementation of the final action plan. So that's the RDR guide in a very brief description. We are working on our website right now to include a regional and infrastructure resilience toolkit, which will include some templates for action plans. It'll include some samples of workshops that could be held to bring together the stakeholders and work on specific functions. It'll include some lessons learned from some of the other users. And I recommend that at the end of March, you visit our website to take a look at these tools. If you're interested in downloading the RDR guide, you can do so by just going to our homepage at www.tisp.org, or you can send us an email to request a copy. We do charge a small fee of $25 per copy. That's basically just to cover the shipping and handling, and we're always willing to lower the cost for multiple purchases of the copies. The next edition of the RDR guide will be published in 2016, and in 2014, TISP transitions its focus from strategic perspectives of resilience to operationalizing resilience, and that's basically what we're going to talk about now. Last year, the Office of Infrastructure Protection was mandated by the Homeland Security Act of 2002 and the Presidential Policy Directive 21 for Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience to update the National Infrastructure Protection Plan. The Office of Infrastructure Protection facilitated an open public collaborative process, which was led by Bob Kolaski, to write and edit the NIP. TISP participated in that process, and it was very collaborative, and we appreciated being invited in and having the opportunity to work closely with our federal partners, and we were quite pleased with the end of the product. One of the things we worked on first off was with the Homeland Security Policy Institute within George Washington University. We held a forum on July 25th that looked at the NIP as it currently stood and how it was utilized and viewed. Then it also looked at what would the updated, revised version of the NIP look like. So if it was your dream and you got everything we wanted out of the next version of the NIP, what would that be? We took all of that information and we wrote it down into a nice white paper and submitted it to the Office of Infrastructure Protection, offering up a set of recommendations on how to revise the National Infrastructure Protection Plan. Our recommendations included that the original NIP, the 2006-2009 versions of the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, were still valid. They were good frameworks, and that we should continue to work in that risk management approach with our GCC and SEC partners. We also recommended that same network needed to be brought down to the state and local levels, and how one way they can do that is through a greater expansion of the public-private partnership model. We also recommended that the NIP include a transfer of some knowledge and tool sets that have been developed within the federal agencies for the purpose of implementing the NIP. Not all of that had been brought down to the state and local levels, and by expanding out the partnerships, you're going to be able to do that more easily. Further recommendations included that the process be a united effort, that everybody is in this together, we need to do it together. The new NIP should include specific actions that can be taken by the partnerships, by companies, by agencies, so that they know that they're heading in the right direction. Lastly, we offered up additional recommendations to include educational and training programs so that they have the skill sets to implement the action items established within the NIP. And we also recommended that a network and relationship building process be added in as well. Altogether, when the NIP came out in December 2013, we were pretty pleased as it really didn't recreate the wheel. It was basically the same document that existed before, but opened up some new doors, some new windows down at the state and local level. So it enabled that more joint work could actually be accomplished through public-private partnership. It had a greater focus on risk management and risk assessment. You'll see that documented through there. It also included a set of action items, which my understanding is there aren't any specific documents today that show off what is currently happening in those particular action items. But that document is being considered for development, my understanding. And it enabled that the And it also set up this closer collaboration, this closer integration in between the cybersecurity effort along with the National Infrastructure Protection Plan and the National Preparedness System and Goal. So it offered this opportunity to tighten the connections between many of the initiatives and programs, which we weren't actually seeing how those were going to be connected. So we really appreciate how the new document is helping to move this along for us. One of the other items that we have been working on is a regional resilience workshop series, and we do this in partnership with the Society of American Military Engineers posts. We held six particular workshops last year in many places like Dallas and St. Louis and the Philadelphia region. And the purpose behind the workshop series was to take one particular national dialogue and bring it down to the regional level and get the regional perspective. How does these things actually impact them? So this was the first year that we actually did this, and we looked at how the mitigation strategies were being applied for helping to set the priorities for infrastructure investment made at the community or regional level. We had great attendance at these particular events and gathered a lot of information. We were able to focus our discussions within five particular areas. We were able to focus on strategies and frameworks, policy and legislation, finance and partnerships, risk assessment and information sharing, and civic and cultural factors. As a result, we wrote a white paper, which is currently being edited right now, and the five basic recommendations came out, and we were a little shocked by the information that we got from the regions. We were thinking that we would directly talk about finance issues and how you can actually address some of those things more directly. But what we heard more frequently is there are some other things that we can work on which would have greater impact and open more possibilities in the areas for helping to establish priorities. First of all, most regions don't have a clear understanding of their infrastructure inventory. So they recommended that states and communities develop that inventory as as an as-is condition and also an understanding of how, when stressed, what some of the impacts could be. So gaining a better understanding of perhaps some loss estimation from particular hazards. Another item was to consider how to address dependencies of lifeline infrastructure and supply chain logistics infrastructure. A third recommendation is to use a development plan to guide the principles for mitigating risks and making communities more resilient to all hazards. While there are many regions that work on the development of development plans for the transportation sectors primarily or within some other smart growth areas, rarely do they apply that to mitigate risks. We are looking at how the communities are looking at how they can actually make that happen. In other words, bring in the emergency managers as part of that planning process. And we're also looking at cost-cutting measures to do more with less. We had talked a little bit about the issues about not having time limits for the proposal process. By cutting down the time limit of proposal process from a decade down to 1 or 2 years, you'll be able to save the developers millions of dollars. And they also wanted to highlight the need to educate the different types of partnership models that exist today. And this is both from a financing partnership model to the risk management or resilience partnership model. So they get a better understanding of how work can be accomplished in a concerted effort. Another particular item that CIS works on is the Critical Infrastructure Symposium that it holds every single year. We began doing this with the West Point 4 or 5 years ago. Basically, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Hart came to me 1 year and he basically said, I have this idea of putting on this meeting where we bring together the academic community, both the educator and the student. We bring in the practitioners. And we also bring in some senior leaders to all sit around the table and talk about infrastructure resilience. And the whole concept was he is teaching this at the West Point. He'd only been doing it for X number of years, less than 10. And the students have been learning about it for 6 months. And the amount of information that was out there about this particular topic and the amount of information you can gain through research was very comparable. So we're all basically at the same level. So why can't we learn from one another and help develop the programs that will develop the Sentinels we'll need in the future? So that was the whole idea behind this. This, like I said, is our fifth one that we're holding. We are doing it out in Colorado Springs, West Point, the Air Force Academy, Colorado Technical University, Penn State University, and U.S. NORTHCOM. And the Office of Infrastructure Protection are all working together to put together the program for this year's symposium. We do have a call for papers that is out right now that closes on January 29th. I recommend that you find that on our website, www.tisp.org, to find out more details about the process for submitting a paper or an abstract. This year we are expanding the symposium to include a workshop on public-private partnerships, so if you're interested in learning how you can get engaged or how you can actually establish your own partnership, we'll help with that dialogue and discussion in the workshop. We'll also be offering two training courses, one offered by Argonne Labs as they're looking at their RMI tool, the Resilience Measures Initiative tool. And also the Office of Infrastructure Protection will provide a training course on the National Infrastructure Protection Plan 2013. Some other primary events where you can get engaged. We are bringing back many of our founders together, and we do so on a quarterly basis so that we can talk about the particular topics of resilience when I'm focused on the architecture, engineering, and construction arenas. We're also convening stakeholders on a monthly basis through our National Resilience Coalition, which brought together several of the associations who have an interest on national resilience. And we're just communicating with one another on those particular initiatives. We do this through a conference call and webinar tool, so this gives you an opportunity to learn from that. We will hold a webinar as well with the Society of American Military Engineers, looking at operationalizing the operational plan for the critical infrastructure security and resilience that will be provided by Bob Kolaski at the Office of Infrastructure Protection. The date for that has not been formally set, but it is the last week of February. In May or June, we'll be doing a congressional event trying to educate our legislators on what resilience is all about and how it's going to impact their constituents. And we'll continue to work with the Society of American Military Angel Posts on several events. And, of course, we'll rerun the workshop series. Additionally, to help transition from a strategic resilience down to an operational resilience discussion, we are conducting four roundtables. One is the Legal Issues and Building Resilience Roundtable, which is chaired in partnership with the American Bar Association, with Ernie Egger of Atkins and Denise Krepp of Penn State University facilitating these dialogues. Not many organizations have been looking at some of the legal issues of working within a partnership for resilience. So that's some of the concerns that we're actually looking at today in this particular roundtable. We're also brought together Michelle Dean from ANSI and Kevin Morley from the American Water Works Association to help facilitate a dialogue around resilience standards and measures. And basically what we're looking at here is not sector-specific standards, but we're looking at regional standards. So how are you going to be able to measure that your community is heading within a resilient framework? We're looking at how military installations and the communities that are around them can work together on resilience strategies now that less money is actually going to be spent for mission assurance and more focused on cybersecurity. They're going to have to rely on the communities around them to help build a regional plan. And lastly, we are, by the way, the facilitator for that dialogue is currently Paul Stockton. And the last roundtable is bringing together the climate adaptation, sustainability, and resilience. The chairs for that are Jerry Brashear and Paula Scalingi, both of our board. As I said, we're working on developing our new website to include a whole host of tools. So I highly recommend you revisit our website in late March when all of these types of resources will be found. And if you're interested in learning about our committees and getting involved, we have four committees. One co-chaired by Ed Hecker of the Army Corps of Engineers and Mohan Singh of AECOM looks at regional and infrastructure resilience. And one of the things they're focusing on is developing a set of principles for resilience. So if you're interested in learning how these will actually impact your region and communities, I highly encourage you to get engaged. We're currently developing a steering group because we're going to work on many items, and the steering group's focus is to collaborate and coordinate those functions. If you're interested, contact us. Chaired by Jay Manick and Paula Scalingi is our Public-Private Collaboration Committee. One of the first things they're focused on is developing that workshop, the training tools, on how you can actually put together public-private partnerships. We also have the Knowledge, Skills, and Education Committee that is currently chaired by Lieutenant Colonel Steve Hart of the West Point. He'll be stepping down in the beginning of April, and Wayne Boone from Carleton University will be taking the chair role here. Their primary function is to help develop the program for the Critical Infrastructure Symposium, but some of the other things they're working on is developing a Scholar and Resilience Initiative. So if you're interested in getting involved in that and helping to establish some research and case study projects for universities, then get in touch with us. We also have the Infrastructure Standards and Measures Resilience Committee, which is chaired by Eve Hinman of Hinman Engineering Consultants, and their primary focus is supporting the roundtable right now, looking at resilience standards and measures. And I thank you for listening to our presentation. As you see, is our contact information. We are available to answer any of your questions at any time. So please get in touch with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. That's quite impressive, everything that you all have on your plate. We are ready to move to our Q&A, and merely just type your question or make a comment in the Q&A panel. Please do select host from the drop-down menu to send it to me. You just type in the area underneath that, and then you just hit enter, click on send. And then I will read the questions or comments aloud, and our guests will respond via the bridge. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And we are ready to begin now, so you can enter your comment or question at any time. And one of the things I wanted to specifically point out, Bill, is on your website currently, you have an amazing resource library already.
We try to maintain that resource library and grow it. So we're always interested in receiving new materials, and we look at these as gateway libraries. So if you have a tool set or a description of an initiative, that would be helpful just to give us that and a link to learn more directly from your organization.
Very good. And I am going to go ahead and put up your contact information again as we go through the Q&A. And I was also interested, one of the things I had jotted down to ask you about was metrics. And I see, you know, you're having planned to, well, you have a whole committee for that and this roundtable. And I'm just wondering, in terms of measuring resilience, did you have any recommendations on that for the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, or is there any starting point for that in existence already?
There are a few initiatives that are underway or are already established. SPUR in San Francisco, for example, has been able to establish their as-is condition today for their infrastructure and then made it a determination on where they'd like to take that infrastructure so that it can become more resilient within a set time period. That is a set of measurement. So that's an interesting way of addressing it from a community standpoint or a regional standpoint. Then you have other organizations like the American Water Works Association, which had already developed a resilience metric for their installations. And now that has been around, I believe, for somewhere between 3 and 5 years, but they really haven't seen any organizations run a complete analysis since those have been adopted. What's nice about their standards is they had actually gone through the Safety Act compliance process. So not only do they have industry standards, but they're Safety Act compliant. That's a brilliant move. There are a few other organizations that have been working on it from a sector perspective, but nobody seems to have an agreed upon process or a wide range of acceptance other than AWWA.
So they have their work cut out for them, right?
Yes, they do.
The committee and the roundtable. Okay, we do have a few questions from our audience I'd like to get to. And first one is from Isabel. She says, hi, Bill, and Happy New Year. What Canadian partners are included in your organization, and could you elaborate on the Canadian project? Isabel is, of course, from Canada and quite interested in impacts up there.
First of all, Isabel, I invite you to reach out to us. I'd love to talk to you a little bit more in detail about it. Secondly, just to answer your question briefly, we have been working with many of the Canadian agencies in the past, more frequently when it comes to some of our partners like the PENWAR organization in the Northwest and the Great Lakes Hazards Coalition in the Great Lakes region. So we communicate on a regular basis with those organizations. But we also work with many of the universities, like Carleton University, with Wayne Boone chairing one of our committees. There is a Public Private Partnership in Canada, which escapes me right now. The executive director for that partnership is Grant Leckie, and I apologize for not remembering the title of his partnership. But we have been working together on how can you establish an international network of partnerships to share information on these resilience initiatives. And that's a starting point on building a network. It's a wonderful idea, and we're trying to get behind it and help push it forward with them.
So would the approach there be kind of a network of networks, basically, huh?
You got it. You got it. And the only purpose is just to get together and talk about what you're doing at this point and see how that actually grows into something of a more matured structure.
Very good. Okay, Sean Smith is asking about the disaster losses that you quoted. He says you quoted $1.4 trillion in global disaster costs for 2000 to 2010. What is your source for this figure? He believes this number seems a little bit high.
I had done some Google searches looking at articles, looking at what FEMA had been reporting and some insurance organizations talking about where money had actually been spent. A lot of this was just compiled based off of the tax dollars that were authorized for rehabilitation. And you just added all of that up. The average $80 billion just came up from adding up those four-year periods of 2009 through 2012. Which was a little more than $320 billion. So that's where I got those figures from. Like I said when I gave the report, nobody's really tracking that on an official basis. So I'm just going off of what we see in our media reports today for the U.S. The other figure of $1.4 trillion, that is tracked, and the U.N. actually tracks that. So you can actually go to the U.N., and I believe they have a resilience program where you can actually find those figures on that. They have several presentations on it.
Okay. We have Dennis Schrader with us, who is active in your organization, and he says, Bill, could you discuss the notion of empowering regional partnerships and how they relate to the RCCC and TISP? What is the benefit to state and local EMAs?
There's quite a few benefits to regional partnerships. There are many different types of partnerships out there. We're just now learning more about what are some of the capabilities, but we've already seen some of the benefits. By directly working within partnerships, you're engaging the companies within your regions and talking about the particular issues that you all would confront in a disaster situation and how you can all work together to mitigate that. So that means the private sector has an opportunity to help establish the policies within that particular region. So you're already getting buy-in for the emergency management community on what are the best approaches to mitigate the risks within that region. You also get a buy-in from that same private sector community on what those real risks are. You get to share information with one another if that's actually one of the goals within that partnership to actually do something like that. You actually get to share what type of information that you actually need. So there are many other reasons why you can actually work together in these particular partnerships, which go beyond the financial benefit. There is also the buy-in from the community.
Very good. One of the things, we are kind of getting to the end of our hour, but we do have time for a couple of additional questions and comments. I got one from Sean before I get to that one. I was wondering, one of the things that really caught my ear for what you have coming up is your congressional outreach. Can you just kind of very briefly sketch that out a little bit, what you plan to be doing there?
I'm sorry, could you say that one more time?
Oh, I was asking about, you had an event coming up, I guess you would call it an educational workshop on the Hill.
Oh, yeah, the Hill event. I've asked Denise Karep, who once worked on the House Homeland Security Committee, to help us with developing a program. that will bring together many of our stakeholders currently working on resilience initiatives. And what we're, the idea is to educate the legislators on what these programs will have as an impact to their constituents. It also will include a set of recommendations on some programs that can actually be either implemented at the state level or implemented at the federal level to help with demonstrating some of the programs within the National Infrastructure Protection Plan or within any other type of national resilience program.
Okay. Well, we wish you good luck on that.
Very much. And if you're interested in getting involved in that, reach out to us because we're always looking for ways to improve any program.
There you go. Okay, I got one more from Sean Smith, and he asks, what is TISP doing with respect to helping make plans truly operational? Does your toolkit address linking plans to resource management so that current response capabilities can be measured and whole community capacity building can be accommodated? That's a bit long, but...
Well, of course we'd like to get there. But it takes time, and since we're building the toolkit from the ground up, what we're trying to do is get the low-hanging fruit first, and we do have it in our plans, at least, to head in that direction. So over the next year or two, you may actually see that actually come out as a toolkit item. But today, it is not going to happen, or by the end of this year, it's not going to happen. But perhaps in 2015, 2016, as part of the rollout of the next edition of the Regional Disaster Resilience Guide, you may see it there.
And I'm impressed, you know, that this is a long-term effort, not only for your organization, but for the country at home.
It's generational. You got it.
Yes. It's not going to happen tomorrow. One thing I did want to follow up, you mentioned TISP was putting together a white paper on the results of those regional workshops, I believe.
Yes, we are putting together a white paper. Like I said, we have a pretty good final draft of it already, but it's being edited. So we're hoping that the beginning of February we'll actually have it out in the hands of the public.
Oh, very good. Okay, that's where I was going with that question, was when that might be available, because as you mentioned, some of the recommendations that came out of those were quite original, right?
Yeah, they weren't so much original. I mean, we've heard those before, but we never really thought that those would rise to a higher level importance than trying to figure out how you can actually fund infrastructure projects, considering the place that we're in today with our funding our federal government actions and how that actually rolls downhill into the state and local levels. So, you know, we were just a little surprised by that.
And you do plan, did you say you were going to repeat those regional workshops this coming year?
We're going to have another set of workshops. The topic is currently being considered right now. One of the leading ideas is looking at the top 10 initiatives for resilience. So if you are a state or community, what are the top 10 things that you should be working on to develop a resilience program?
Well, very good. Well, good luck with that, too. It is time to kind of wrap it up for today. So on behalf of Ava Jean and myself and all our participants, thank you very much, Bill, for being with us and sharing this information. And we also hope that your symposium this coming spring will be very successful.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. I look forward to working with many of you.
Very good. And, folks, before you go, please do take a moment to provide a little feedback about today's program and enter any additional comments you may have. And you have the contact information for following up with Bill directly if you would like to do so. Now, our next program will be February 12th, when our topic will be the critical role of purchasing and procurement in disaster cost recovery, and our guest will be Michael Martinet, principal of the Martinet Group, who specializes in disaster finance training and cost recovery planning. So that might be a good one to mark down on your calendar. But please note, we will be moving to a new webinar platform next month, that will enhance our capability to support participation via mobile devices. So please do watch for new instructions in the near future. And if you are not on our mailing list, you can go to our homepage, amforum.org, and there is a place to sign up there. So thanks to everyone for participating today, and we hope you have a great afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Bye now.